This is an ABC podcast.
Here's the bleeding obvious. Council shouldn't have to do this sort of stuff. However, if we like to look after our residents, council feels that it is necessary.
The New South Wales state and federal governments are being called upon to compensate New South Wales councils that are using ratepayers' money to keep vital health services afloat. That story soon. And the canary in the condamine. Scientists are worried the decline of a once abundant fish species in southern Queensland could be a red flag for the health of broader parts of the Murray-Darling Basin.
They're a good indicator that if things are going wrong, they're the first one to sort of have a telltale sign because they don't have that ability to move around and potentially find better habitat.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. We start tonight in New South Wales, where a late submission to a parliamentary inquiry has revealed a number of councils are having to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to attract doctors and maintain health services, a funding responsibility that's usually handled by the state and federal governments. And these councils are calling for compensation. Our reporter Joanna Woodburn has been following this story. Joanna, can you explain the parliamentary inquiry where this information has been revealed?
Yes, Alex. So this is an inquiry that has been running all year. So we had submissions that closed at the beginning of 2021. We're now in, November, and the hearings are still ongoing. There are four still scheduled to occur, two of which are happening on Thursday and Friday this week. So this is a late submission, as you said, from Local Government New South Wales, which is the representative body for the state's councils. And it's accusing the New South Wales and federal governments of shifting some of the cost of health services, the delivery of health services, and the recruitment and retention of doctors onto councils, because while they're not necessarily sending the bills to the councils themselves, but councils are identifying a shortfall in funding, which they're having to make up the difference for and having to pull money out of council coffers, which is usually allocated to council activities like, you know, fixing potholes, rubbish deliveries, council utilities, that type of thing.
And how much are councils paying to maintain these health services? What sort of amounts are we talking?
Well, quite a lot. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, not that much on a state level, but for these small rural councils, which have relatively small rate bases, so not a huge number of residents to be able to raise revenue, the Local Government New South Wales submission identifies more than $1 million that more than 20 councils fork out each year. The highest amount paid is at the Forbeshire Council, so in the state's central west, and it lists about $367,000, which is paid each year for various types of expenses. The Carrishool Shire, which is out in the Riverina, it has the second highest bill, if you like, for want of a better word. Lots of other councils and one council organisation, it's sort of tens of thousands of dollars, but still coming out of their coffers. And the submission from Local Government New South Wales points to the fact that one of these councils is spending about 4% of its revenue just on subsidising health services and sort of trying to attract doctors. And the president of Local Government New South Wales, Linda Scott, spoke to the ABC and just basically said, this is just not on.
But asking us to be responsible for core state and federal responsibilities, for example, healthcare, is just wrong. We have small regional councils spending up to 4% of their total rate revenue on healthcare.
So that's Linda Scott, who's the president of Local Government New South Wales, that has lodged this submission to the inquiry.
And Joanna, what are councils having to fund? What are they actually putting their money towards here?
Well, a range of things. It can be accommodation for medical staff. It can be paying for the cost of a car for a doctor. So basically providing those incentives to stay in the community, you know, a bit of a carrot approach will cover your accommodation and some of your operating expenses. Other councils are subsidising the cost of medical centres. So it's speaking to doctors, they say it is quite hard to balance the books at a medical centre with bulk billing and various things, and also just the throughput. Not having a huge number of patients in a community affects obviously the bottom line. So propping up medical centres to ensure that they can remain viable and stay open. Another council in the Riverina, the Wagga Wagga City Council, waives the landing fees for medical flights to make that a little bit easier. So it's a whole range of things, but predominantly it is medical centres and recruitment incentive schemes to try to attract and retain doctors to these communities. As I mentioned before, the Forbeshire Council spends the most, according to the submission. And we can hear now from the Mayor of Forbes, Phyllis Miller, and the council itself has actually gone in with doctors to build a walk-in, walk-out medical centre to make it easier to get staff to that town.
If we didn't build a medical centre in Forbes, we would not have doctors. We also own the Aboriginal Medical Centre, and we've done a lot of work with the Aboriginal people for their health services in Forbes. If we didn't do it, it wouldn't get done.
So that's the Mayor of Forbes, Phyllis Miller, making quite a blunt statement that if councils didn't get involved, some things just would not happen.
And Joanna, what are they seeking as far as compensation in regards to these expenses?
Yes, so they're actually asking for three things. First of all, they want an acknowledgement that there is this cost shifting occurring. And, you know, working in regional New South Wales, we've heard a lot of cost shifting stories, whether it be healthcare or looking after Crown Land or whatever it is. But they want an acknowledgement from both tiers of government that this is actually occurring. They also want an intergovernmental governance model, which basically puts local government at the table to be involved in the delivery and how things are allocated, funding is allocated. And yes, they want to be reimbursed. So any monies paid by councils to prop up what should be a state or a federal responsibility when it comes to healthcare, they want that money to be brought back to the community so that ratepayers aren't worse off.
And at this stage, have we had a response from the state or federal government?
Not yet, but that's not unusual. This submission, as I said, has just been lodged as a late submission with the inquiry. The inquiry is ongoing. We've still got, as I mentioned, four hearings left at least, and then the committee will adjourn the hearings to go away and basically pull all of the hours and pages of evidence together to provide a report to the government. And then the government, if this is one of the recommendations that the committee makes, then the government will respond. So still a long time until we get an answer.
It will be interesting to see how they do respond to this. Our reporter there in Orange, Joanna Woodburn. Thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It is wonderful to have your company. And a little later on the program, we will head to Victoria, where a mystery bird that puzzled a wildlife carer has turned out to be one of the rarest bird sightings in Australia.
They are a long-distance migrant, so it's possible that what we call flyways, the pathway that different migrant birds get into, it's possible that it ended up in the wrong flyway. So rather going south within Africa, for example, it's come across a bit too far east or west, depending on your perspective, and ended up coming down the East Asian, Australasian flyway. So it's come into Australia that way.
That story later in the program.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
To South Australia now, where the federal government has officially selected a property near the town of Kimber for the nation's first nuclear waste storage facility. The decision comes after 6 years of consultation with the local community. Georgia Roberts is our reporter in Port Pirie and has been following this. Georgia, what is the significance of this announcement today?
Well, Alex, to put it plainly, it's official. It's the first official announcement. As you mentioned, 6 years of Kimber being in the running to be the nuclear waste facility of choice. Of course, that National Radioactive Waste Management Bill has been around for quite some time, 40 years, Resources Minister Keith Pitt said today. Well, there have been many other sites that have been in the running, but today Kimber officially announced. Kimber has been consulted at some level by the government. The Australian Electoral Commission actually ran a ballot in Kimber to see if those in Kimber would vote in favour of the facility being in their town. 60% of those that live in Kimber did vote yes, so are in support of the bill. The nuclear waste facility itself is actually just going to be placed out of Kimber at a station called Nepandi. Now, the landowner there has also been a champion for this site to be chosen. days, and I'm sure a lot of people are kind of, I guess, glad that the process is, well, seems to be over. However, there is some contention around who was consulted over this site.
You mentioned there in relation to that particular vote that was had, around 60% of people suggesting they're in favour of it. What has been the reaction in the local community to this now becoming official there, that Kimber will be the location for the nation's first nuclear waste storage facility?
Well, as I mentioned, 40 years of consultation and 6 years of, in Kimber in particular. So I can imagine a couple of locals, so probably the 60%, are relieved that it's finalised. There has been several grants that have been sent Kimber's way. More recently, they were voted Ag Town of the Year. Lots of, I guess, attention being put on this outback town in South Australia. I could imagine as well, of course, some relief, but also those that would have wanted to have been further consulted. But the boundaries of Kimber, it's in outback South Australia. There are a lot of people who surround that area who feel as though they also should have been consulted. And also the local native title group, the Bungala people, whose land the site will be built on, would have liked to have seen further consultation with them. They've been following this quite closely today, releasing a statement saying that there have been significant and repeated grave problems with the government's conduct regarding the site selection process, and they remain confident that once assessed by the court, the declaration to locate the facility at Nepandi on our country will likely be overturned. So alluding there to some Supreme Court action from the Bungala Native Title Group.
What does happen now as far as where we go from here with this announcement?
There will be some Supreme Court action. The Bungala Native Title Group have mentioned that in the past, over the last few years. As soon as that ballot was taken of Kimber, in fact, the Native Title Group made that announcement that they would be taking Supreme Court action. There were other sites that were considered in the original bill, and that actually meant that on a legal technicality that the Native Title Group could pursue that Supreme Court action. Now officially being chosen as Nepandi means that the wheels will start turning. We're yet to hear from anything more from the Native Title Group, but we'll see what's to come. Some pretty strong words in that they're sure that the conduct the government's taken means that the declaration to locate the facility there will likely be overturned. So it is a wait and see.
So, Georgia, what will this mean for the local economy? What will this bring to the area of Kimber?
Well, what it's been sold as, Alex, is a boost for the local economy, and it will be that. I mean, there are some jobs that will be created, 45, in fact, across fields, you know, such as security, administration, environmental monitoring, and in science and health and safety. So some boost in the local economy, and I'm sure, as I mentioned, we'll see those jobs. It puts Kimber on the map, so to speak, a small town nestled in the outback or on South Australia's Eyre Peninsula.
Georgia Roberts is our reporter in Port Pirie. She's been talking us through this announcement that the federal government has officially selected a property near the town of Kimber for the nation's first nuclear waste storage facility. Georgia, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if it never come?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
Yes, you are on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. And a reminder, you can always email us. We'd love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. australiawide.radio@abc.net.au is the email to get you there. A tiny fish once caught by the bucketful in Queensland's Upper Condamine River is now on the verge of extinction. Scientists are worried the Northern River Blackfish, more commonly known as the Nicky Fish or the Nicky Long Cod, could be the signalling of an environmental collapse in the Murray-Darling Basin river system. South Queensland reporter Belinda Sanders has the story.
They're an interesting little critter and I think definitely underappreciated and undervalued, but I'm hoping that this can hopefully bring some more public knowledge how cool they are, really.
Dr. Mishka Tershwell is a research fellow at Griffith University who has developed a close connection with the tiny fish. He is worried the Northern River blackfish, more commonly known as the Nicky fish or Nicky long cod by locals, could be the marker of environmental collapse in the Murray-Darling Basin river system. The species is experiencing severe decline and is already highly vulnerable to localised extinctions. 100-year-old Killarney resident Bernice Peterson remembers her grandmother catching the Northern River blackfish by the bucketful.
She used to walk from Killarney to up to the kiosk over daytime to fish. But she caught a lot of neckies and crawfish, and we used to dangle the line alongside hers because she was catching them all. Oh, they used to share them around if they got too many. It was sweet. They used to get Nicky fish out at the back of the Louises there. There's a waterfall there, and they used to catch Nickies there too at one time.
I wouldn't think that there'd be much fishing going on in that creek today.
No. The rivers wouldn't be suitable now to fish from.
Aboriginal elder Sam Bonner says his people would drink from the streams near Killarney decades ago.
We never looked after our water, and how could they look after water? They cut all the wooden trees out and everything. They drive them through the water all the time. They should put a bridge through here, concrete bridge or something, and where the water can run through underneath. That dirt there, look at that. That's, you get here for a weekend, cars coming through here all the time. And this water here is muddy. That's no good.
Natural Resource Management Group Southern Queensland Landscapes will try to reduce sediment and increase natural habitat in streams over the next 2 years, where blackfish still exist, including Killarney in the headwaters of the Condamine River. Dr. Tershwell says the time is now.
I think the key is rehabilitating those riparian zones, because the riparian vegetation is such a multifaceted benefit for in-stream fish and fauna. It provides sort of the shade for the blackfish, it helps reduce the sediment load in the streams, which impacts their habitat, helps provide food and shelter and protection from predators. So number one is that, basically fencing, removing those activities that are impacting streams and trying to rehabilitate the riparian zone.
The stakes are high because Dr. Tershwell says the upper Condamine headwaters is critical for maintaining blackfish presence in Queensland, if not the wider basin.
So I guess the blackfish have sort of been described as a canary in the Condamine, and I think it's a really good analogy and something that I actually mentioned in one of my PhD papers. I think one of the key factors is that they're a non-migratory species. So they're a good indicator that if things are going wrong, they're the first ones to sort of have a telltale sign, because they don't have that ability to move around and potentially find better habitat. So for another species that's more mobile, they might be able to find somewhere that's more preferable. But for blackfish, they're pretty much stuck where they are. And if they'd go in decline, the system's in a bit of trouble.
See this water? Human beings don't own that water. It's not all for human beings. Now we've got trees here need water. We've got animals that need water. We've got fish that need good water. We've got birds that need water. By right, humans should be last. We should be last. That's the way our people see it.
That's Aboriginal Elder Sam Bonner ending that report on the Northern River Blackfish by Southern Queensland reporter Belinda Sanders.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
And finally tonight, we head to Victoria where a mystery bird that puzzled a wildlife carer has turned out to be a historic find. The little falcon turned out to be a Eurasian hobby, a bird that's never been seen in eastern Australia and only spotted a handful of times in WA. Bird watchers and scientists alike are speculating that the La Nina weather system and climate change may have led the bird half a world away from its intended destination. Gippsland reporter Rio Davis has the story.
What I do is wildlife care. I just do
birds of prey. I've been doing this for pretty much over 25 years now, so it doesn't take me long to look at a bird to know what it is in a bit of a flash, but this one pretty well messed with my head because it didn't fit all the criteria of anything that I've seen before. It was brought to me by another rescuer. I examined the bird and was able to see that it had a broken wing. I arranged for it to be transported to the vets. I took it in and we had x-rays done. It was confirmed that it does have a broken wing, so it does need treatment. It will need surgical treatment in the likes of a pin to try and stabilise the wing to hopefully get it flying again.
To identify the mystery bird, Linda called in the help of Monash University ornithologist Rowan Clark.
So there are a long-distance migrant, and they breed in the Northern Hemisphere, as the name suggests, you know, Eurasian, meaning that they're occupying Europe and Asia. And then they migrate south, but they don't normally migrate into Australia. So there's a tiny number of records over in Western Australia, but as I said, this is the first record for Eastern Australia, so a very rare bird down this far.
Were there any particular environmental factors that you suspect might have drawn it here?
They are a long-distance migrant, so it's possible that what we call flyways, so the pathway that different migrant birds get into, it's possible that it ended up in the wrong flyway. So rather, you know, going south within Africa, for example, it's come across a bit too far east or west, depending on your perspective, and ended up coming down the East Asian, Australasian flyway. So it's come into Australia that way is a likely driver.
And when it comes to, obviously, we've just had a La Nina weather system declared over the Pacific Ocean, does that interact with the flyways of birds at all?
We do see a trend for more vagrants. So we call these birds vagrants in that they've ended up in a place that's unexpected. And in La Nina years, we certainly get more vagrant turning up in different places. This is an extreme all the way down in Victoria. But at this particular year, we're already seeing, you know, more records of vagrants on some of the offshore islands off northwestern Australia, for example. Normally, we'd expect falcons to migrate on their own. So just singletons sort of going through and heading south or north, depending on the time of year. But over in Perth, the very first Australian record was a bird discovered in Perth 5 or 6 years ago, and it was an adult. And the very next year, at the exact same spot, a juvenile was found. And because of the age, it tells us definitively that, you know, there were two different birds involved. It seems remarkable that they were found at exactly the same spot. But we do know they breed in the Northern Hemisphere, so these are two different birds that have migrated all the way to Perth in 2 different years.
But it's not just La Nina that's wreaking havoc on birds' navigation skills. BirdLife Australia's Sean Dooley says it's also a changing climate.
It does seem like it could be a good year, and whether that has anything to do with La Nina or climate change, we don't know for individual birds, but certainly we know the rate of vagrant birds turning up in Australia. That rate is increasing due to climate change. There is so much grim news with birds as we lose so many populations are dwindling across Australia and the globe. In one sense, it really does. It is a positive for the enjoyment of birdwatchers because you never know what's going to turn up. And having all these seemingly fairly exotic and unexpected birds showing up on your doorstep is a real thrill. It certainly saves us the air miles of having to fly to their natural habitat in other countries to see them.
In your role with BirdLife Australia, what is it like sort of chronicling the incremental changes that we're seeing with climate change in this context?
Yes, we're certainly finding that the data that we've been analysing is showing that, as predicted, certain birds are really suffering due to the effects of climate change on their habitat, on their migration routes, on those sorts of things. And it is very dispiriting, and it can seem overwhelming, but we do know, on the other hand, that conservation efforts work when we put the correct resources in and make it a community and government and NGO effort. We can turn around the fortunes of a lot of our endangered birds. So there is that hope that if we take this seriously, and I think by taking it seriously, you've also got to take time to enjoy the beauty of birds. And that is one of the things that keep a lot of people in our line going, is just the fact that birds are magnificent creatures that can literally fly halfway around the world and turn up outside your doorstep. There's marvel and wonder in that, and it's that joy that people get on a daily basis that I think keeps people going in what are otherwise sometimes quite grim circumstances.
That was Gippsland reporter Rio Davis with that story. And if you'd like to see a photo, some pictures of Hubert, the Eurasian hobby, who got a little bit off course from his intended destination, you can head to the ABC Gippsland page or the ABC News website. He is incredibly cute. And that's all from the Australia-wide team for this Monday. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia-wide website. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening. I'll catch you tomorrow. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.